Chapter 9. The bulls ever walk alone to the solitude of their selves, swaggering in their coats of sweaty felt, every vein swollen, defiant and proud in their beastly need, thunderous in step. Make way, the spurting swords, slay damsel hearts, cloven the cut gaping wide, so tender an attitude. And we must swoon before red-rimmed eyes, you'll find no guilt in the self so proven, and the fiery charge of most fertile seed sings like God's rain. Make way, another bold word, the dancers sure to misstep in the rushing drums of the multitude. Dandies of the Promenade, Seglora.
Expectation is the hoary curse of humanity. One can listen to words and see them as the unfolding of a petal, or indeed the very opposite. Each word bent and pushed tighter, smaller, until the very packet of meaning vanishes with a flip of deft fingers. Poets and tellers of tales can be tugged by either current into the riotous conflagration of beauteous language or the pithy reduction of the tersely colourless. As with art, so too with life. See a man without fingers standing at the back of his house. He is grainy with sleep that yields no rest, no relief from a burdensome world, and all that. And his eyes are strangely blank and might be shuttered too as he stares out on the huddled form of his wife as she works some oddity in her vegetable patch. This one is terse. Existence is a most narrow aperture indeed. His failing is not in being inarticulate through some lack of intellect, no. This mind is most finely honed. But he views his paucity of words, in both thought and dialogue, as a virtue, sigil of rigid manhood. He has made brevity an obsession, an addiction, and in his endless paring down he strips away all hope of emotion and with it empathy. When language is lifeless, what does it serve? When meaning is rendered down, what veracity holds to the illusion of depth? Bah, to such conceits! Such anal self-serving affectation! Wax extravagant and let the world swirl thick and pungent about you. Tell the tale of your life as you would live it. A delighted waggle of fingers now might signal mocking cruelty when you are observing this fingerless man who stands silent and expressionless as he studies his woman. Decide as you will, his woman. Yes, the notion belongs to him, artfully whittled from his world view, one of expectation and fury at its perpetual failure. Possession has its rules, and she must behave within the limits those rules prescribe. This was, to Gaz, self-evident, a detail that did not survive his own manic editing. But what was Thordy doing with all those flat stones? With that peculiar pattern she was building there in the dark, loamy soil. One could plant nothing beneath stone, could one? No, she was sacrificing fertile ground. And for what? He didn't know, and he knew that he might never know. As an activity, however, Thordy's diligent pursuit was a clear transgression of the rules, and he might have to do something about that, soon. Tonight he would beat a man to death. Exultation, yes, but a cold kind. Flies buzzing in his head, the sound rising like a wave, filling his skull with 100,000 icy legs. He would do that, yes, and this meant he didn't have to beat his wife. Not yet, anyway. A few more days, maybe a week or so, he would have to see how things went. Keep things simple. Give the flies not much to land on. That was the secret. The secret to staying sane. The wedges of his battered, fingerless hands burned with eager fire. But he wasn't thinking much of anything at all, was he? Nothing to reach his face, his eyes, the flat line of his mouth. Sigil of manhood, this blank facade. And when a man has nothing else, at least he could have that. And he would prove it to himself again and again, night after night. Because this is what artists did. Thordy was thinking of many things, none of them particularly relevant, or so she would have judged if pressed to examination, although, of course, there was no one who might voice such a challenge, which was just as well.
Here in her garden she could float as aimless as a leaf blown down onto a slow, lazy river. She was thinking about freedom. She was thinking about how her mind could turn to stone, the pattern solid and immovable in the face of seemingly unbearable pressures, and the way dust trickled down faint as whispers, unnoticed by any. And she was thinking of the cool, polished surface of these slate slabs, the waxy feel of them, and the way the sun reflected soft, milky white, and not at all painful to rest eyes upon. And she was remembering the way her husband talked in his sleep, a pouring forth of words as if whatever dam held them back in his wakefulness was kicked down and outgushed tales of gods and promises, invitations and bloodlust, the pain of maimed hands and the pain of maiming that those hands delivered. And she noted the butterflies dancing above the row of greens just off to her left, almost within reach if she stretched out a dirt-stained hand. But then those orange-winged sprites would wing away, though she posed them no threat, because life was uncertain and danger waited in the guise of peaceful repose. And her knees ached, and nowhere in her thoughts could be found expectation. Nowhere could be found such hard-edged proof of reality as the framework of what waited somewhere ahead. No hint at all, even as she laid down stone after stone. It was all outside, you see. All outside. The clerk at the office of the Guild of Blacksmiths had never once in his life wielded hammer and tongs. What he did wield demanded no muscles, no weight of impetus atop oaken legs, no sweat streaming down to sting the eyes, no gusts of scalding heat to singe the hairs on the forearms. And so, in the face of a true blacksmith, the clerk gloried in his power. That pleasure could be seen in his small pursed lips turned well down at each end, could be caught in his watery eyes that rested everywhere and nowhere, in his pale hands holding a wooden stylus like an assassin's dagger, the tip stained blue by ink and wax. He sat on his stool behind the broad counter that divided the front room as if guarding the world's wealth and every promise of paradise that membership in this most noble guild offered its hallowed upright members. And the fat man winks. So he sat, and so Barathol Mekkar wanted to reach over the counter, pluck the clerk into the air, and break him in half. Over and over again, until little more than a pile of brittle tailings remained heaped on the scarred counter, with the stylus thrust into it like a warrior's sword stabbing a barrow. Dark was the amusement in Barathol's thoughts as the clerk shook his head yet again.
"It is simple, even for you, I'm sure. The guild demands credentials, specifically the sponsorship of an accredited guild member. Without this, your coin is so much dross."
And he smiled at this clever pun voiced to a smith.
"I am new to Darujistan," Barathol said again, "and so such sponsorship is impossible."
"Yes, it is."
"As for apprenticeship?"
"Also impossible. You say you have been a blacksmith for many years now, and I do not doubt such a claim. The evidence is plain before me. This, of course, makes you overqualified as an apprentice and too old besides."
"If I cannot be apprenticed, how can I get a sponsor?"
A smile of the lips and shake of the head, a holding up of the palms.
"I don't make the rules, you understand."
"Can I speak to anyone who might have been involved in devising these rules?"
"A blacksmith? No, alas, they are all off doing smithy things, as befits their profession."
"I can visit one at his or her place of work, then. Can you direct me to the nearest one?"
"Absolutely not. They have entrusted me with the responsibilities of operating the administration of the guild. If I were to do something like that, I would be disciplined for dereliction of duty, and I am sure you do not want that on your conscience, do you?"
"Actually," said Barathol, "that is a guilt I can live with."
The expression hardened.
"Honorable character is an essential prerequisite to becoming a member of the guild."
"More than sponsorship?"
"They are balanced virtues, sir. Now, I am very busy today."
"You were sleeping when I stepped in."
"It may have appeared that way."
"It appeared that way because it was that way.
I have no time to argue with you over what you may or may not have perceived when you stepped into my office.
You were asleep!
You might have concluded such a thing.
I did conclude it, because that is what you were. I suppose that too might result in disciplinary measures once it becomes known to the members.
Your word against mine, and clearly you possess an agenda, one that reflects poorly on your sense of honour.
Since when does honesty reflect poorly on one's sense of honour?
The clerk blinked. Why, when it is vindictive, of course.
Now it was Barathol's turn to pause and attempt a new tack.
I can pay an advance on my dues, a year's worth or more if necessary.
Without sponsorship, such payment would be construed as a donation. There is legal precedent to back that interpretation.
You'd take my coin and give me nothing in return?
That is the essence of a charitable donation, is it not?
I don't think it is, but never mind that. What you are telling me is that I cannot become a member of the Guild of Blacksmiths.
Membership is open to all blacksmiths wishing to work in the city, I assure you. Once you have been sponsored.
Which makes it a closed shop.
A what?
The Malazan Empire encountered closed shops in seven cities. They broke them wide open. I think even some blood was spilled. The Emperor was not one to cringe before professional monopolies of any sort.
Well, the clerk said, licking his slivery lips, thank all the gods the Malazans never conquered Darujistan.
Barathol stepped outside and saw Mallet waiting across the street, eating some kind of flavoured ice in a broadleaf cone. The morning's heat was fast melting the confection, and purple water was trickling down the healer's pudgy hand. His lips were similarly stained. Mallet's thin brows rose as the blacksmith approached.
Are you now a proud, if somewhat poor, a member of the guild?
No, they refused me.
But why? Can you not take some kind of exam?
No.
Oh. So now what, Barathol?
What? Oh, I'll open up a smithy anyway, independent.
Are you mad? They'll burn you out, smash up your equipment, descend on you in a mob and beat you to death, and that's just on opening day.
Barathol smiled. He liked Malazans. Despite everything, despite the countless mistakes the Empire had made, all the blood spilled, he liked the bastards. Hood knew they weren't nearly as fickle as the natives of his homeland. Or, he added wryly, the citizens of Darujistan. To Mallet's predictions, he said,
I've handled worse. Don't worry about me. I plan on working here as a blacksmith, whether the guild likes it or not, and eventually they will have to accept me as a member.
That won't feel very triumphant if you're dead.
I won't be. Dead, that is.
They'll try to stop anyone doing business with you.
I am very familiar with Malazan weapons and armor, Mallet. My work meets military standards in your old empire, and as you know, those are set high.
He glanced across at the healer.
Will the guild scare you off? Your friends?
Of course not. But remember, we're retired.
And being hunted by assassins.
Ah, I'd forgotten about that. You have a point.
Even so, Barathol, I doubt us few Malazans can keep you in business for very long.
The new embassy has a company of guards.
True.
And there are other Malazans living here. Deserters from the campaigns up north.
That's true, too. Though they tend to hide from us. Not that we care. In fact, we'd rather get their business at the bar.
What's the point in grudges? Those that come to me will be told just that then, and so we can help each other.
Mallet tossed the sodden cone away and wiped his hands on his leggings.
They tasted better when I was a young brat, although they were more expensive since a witch was needed to make the ice in the first place. Here, of course, it's to do with some of the gases in the caverns below.
Barathol thought about that for a moment as he looked upon the healer with his purple lips and saw, for the briefest moment, how this man had been when he was a child, and then he smiled once more.
I need to find a suitable location for my smithy. Will you walk with me, Mallet?
Glad to, the healer replied. Now I know the city. What precisely are you looking for?
And so Barathol told him. And oh, how Mallet laughed, and off they went into the city's dark chambers of the heart, where blood flowed in a roar, and all manner of deviousness was possible, if the mind was so inclined. A mind such as Barathol Mekar's, when down was thrown the ghastly gauntlet. The ox, the selfsame ox, swung its head back and forth as it pulled the cartload of masonry into the arched gateway, into blessed shade for a few clumping strides, and then out into the bright heat once more, delicate blonde lashes fluttering, to find itself in a courtyard, and somewhere close was sweet, cool water, the sound as it trickled an invitation, the smell soft as a kiss upon the broad, glistening nose, with its even more delicate blonde hairs, and up rose the beast's massive head, and would not the man with the switch have pity on this weary, thirsty ox? He would not. The cart needed unloading first, and so the ox must stand, silently yearning, jaws working the cud of breakfast with loud, thick sounds of suction and wetly clunking molars. And the flies were maddening, but what could be done about flies? Nothing at all. Not until the chill of night sent them away, and so left the ox to sleep, upright in bovine majesty beneath stars, if one was lucky, which, perhaps, was where the flies slept. Of course, to know the mind of an ox is to waste inordinate amounts of time before recognizing the placid civility of a herbivore's sensibilities. Lift gaze, then, to the two vaguely shifty characters edging in through the gate, not workers struggling to and fro in the midst of the old estate's refurbishment, not clerks nor servants, not masons nor engineers nor inspectors nor weight gaugers nor measurers, to all appearances malingerers, skulkers, but in truth, even worse than that. 12 names on the list, 1 happily struck off, 11 others found and then escaped like the slippery eels they no doubt were, being hunted by debt, ill luck, and the vagaries of a clearly malicious universe intent on delivering misery and whatnot. But no matter such failure among the thugs sent out to enforce collection or deliver punishment. Not the problem of these men now, was it? Bereft of all burdens, blessed with exquisite freedom, Scorch and Lef were here, in this soon-to-be-opulent estate that was even now rising from the dust of neglect and decay to enshroud like a cloak of jewels the mysterious arrival of a noble-born. A woman, it was rumoured, all veiled, but see the eyes! Eyes of such beauty! Why, imagine them widening as I reach down! Scorch and Lef, edging in nervously, barely emerging from the shadow of the arched gate, peering round as if lost, as if moments from running off with stolen chunks of masonry or an armload of bricks or even a bag of iron wedges.
Oh, you two! What do you want here?
Starting guiltily, Scorch staring wide-eyed at the grizzled foreman walking up to them, a gadrobi so bow-legged he looked to be wading hip-deep through mud, Lef ducking his head as if instinctively dodging an axe, which said a lot about his life thus far, didn't it? And then stepping one small pace forward and attempting a smile that fared so poorly it could not even be described as a grimace.
Is there a castellan we could talk to? Lef asked.
About what?
Gate guards, Lef said. We got lots of qualifications.
Oh, any of them relevant?
What?
Lef looked at Scorch and saw the panic spreading like a wildfire on his friend's face. A match to his own growing dismay. Madness, thinking they could just step up another rung on the ladder. Madness.
We could walk her dogs, I mean.
You could. I suppose you could, if the mistress had any.
Does she? Lef asked.
Does she what?
Have any. Dogs we could walk.
Not even ones you can't walk.
We can guard the gate, Scorch shouted. That's what we're here for, to get hard on, you see, as estate guards. And if you don't think we can swing a sword or use a crossbow, why, you don't know us at all, do you?
No, you're right, the foreman replied. I don't.
Lef scowled.
You don't what?
Stay here, the old man said, turning away. While I get Castellan Studlock.
As the foreman waded away through the dust, watched with longing by the ox beside the rubble heap, Left turned on Scorch.
Studlock?
Scorch shrugged helplessly.
I ain't never heard of him. Why, have you?
No, of course not. I'd have remembered.
Why?
Why? Are you a hood-damned idiot?
What are we doing here, Lef?
Torvald said no, remember, to everything. He's too good for us now, so we'll show him. We'll get hard on this fancy estate, as guards, with uniforms and polished buckles and those braided peace straps for our swords. And so he'll curse himself that he didn't want us no more, as partners or anything. It's his wife, I bet. She never liked us at all, especially you, Scorch. So that's what you've done to us, and I won't forget any time soon, neither, so don't even think otherwise.
He shut his mouth then and stood at attention, since the foreman was returning, and at his side pitter-pattered a figure so wrapped up in swaddles of cotton it took 3 steps for every pendulum pitch forward from the foreman. The feet beneath the ragged hem were small enough to be cloven hoofs. A hood covered the castellan's head, and in the shadow of the hood's broad mouth there was something that might have been a mask. Gloved hands were drawn up in a way that reminded Lef, and a moment later Scorch, of a praying mantis. And if this was the estate castellan, then someone had knocked the world askew in ways unimaginable to either Lef or Scorch. The foreman said,
"Here they are, sir."
Were there eyes in the holes of that smooth mask? Who could tell? But the head shifted, and something told both men, like spider legs dancing up their spines, that they were under scrutiny.
"So true,"
Castellan Studlock said in a voice that made Lef think of gravel under the fingernails, while Scorch thought about the way there was always one gull that bullied all the rest, and if the others just ganged up, why, equality and freedom would belong to everyone.
"So true,"
said the swaddled masked man, or woman, but then the foreman had said sir, hadn't he?
"There is need for estate guards. The mistress will be arriving today, in fact, from the outcountry. Proper presentation is desired."
The castellan paused and then leaned forward from the waist, and Lef saw the red glint of unhuman eyes in the holes of the mask.
"You, what is your name?"
"Lef Bahan, sir, is my name."
"You have been eating raw lake conch?"
"What? Not recently."
A rapt finger darted upward and wagged slowly back and forth.
"Risky. Please, open your mouth and stick out your tongue."
"What? Like this?"
"That is fine. Very fine, yes. So,"
the castellan leaned back,
"Greva worms. You are infected. Pustules on your tongue. Dripping sinuses, yes? Itchy eyelids. The eggs do that. And when they hatch, why, the worms will crawl out from the corners of your eyes. Raw lake conch. Tisk, tisk."
Lef clawed at his face.
"Gods, I need a healer. I gotta go."
"No need. I will happily see your ailment treated. You must be presentable to the mistress, yes. Each standing at attention on either side of the gate. Well attired, hale of complexion and parasite free. A small barracks is being readied. It will be necessary to hire at least 3 more to complete the requirements. Do you have reliable friends capable of such work?"
Said
Scorch, when it was obvious that Lef had momentarily lost his facility for speech.
"We might. I could go and see."
"Excellent. And your name is?"
"Scorch. We got references."
"No need. I am confident in my ability to judge character, and I have concluded that you two, while not to be considered vast of intellect, are nevertheless inclined to loyalty. This here will mark an advancement in your careers, I am sure.
And so you will be diligent, as befits your secret suspicion that you have exceeded your competence. All this is well. Also, I am pleased to note that you do not possess any parasites of a debilitating, unsightly sort. So, Scorch, go yonder and find us one, two, or three additional guards. In the meantime, I will attend to Lef Bahan.
Right. Yes, sir. I will do just that.
The foreman was standing nearby, smirking. Neither Scorch nor a stunned Lef noticed this detail, and yes, they should have.
A woman needs her secrets, said Tisera, lifting up an eggshell-thin porcelain cup and holding it in front of the bright sunlight. This one is good, darling. No flaws.
And the hag in the stall grinned, head bobbing. Torvald Nom nodded happily, then licked his lips.
Isn't this fun? He said. Fine crockery to go into our new kitchen, and the fancy oven on its four legs and all. Real drapes, lush furniture, colourful rugs. We can get the storage shed rebuilt, too. Bigger, solid.
Tisera set the cup down and moved directly in front of him.
Husband? Yes? You're trying too hard. I am? Well, it's like a dream, you see, being able to come back home. Do all these things for you, for us. It still doesn't feel real. Oh, that's not the problem, she said. You are already getting bored, Torvald Nom. You need more than just tagging along at my side. And the coin won't last forever. Beru knows I don't make enough for the both of us. You're saying I need to get a job. I will tell you a secret, just one, and keep in mind what I said earlier. We women have many secrets. I'm feeling generous today, so listen well. A woman is well pleased with a mate. He is her island, if you will, solid, secure. But sometimes she likes to swim offshore, out away, floating, facing the sun, if you will. And she might even dive from sight, down to collect pretty shells and the like. And when she's done, why, she'll swim back to the island. The point is, husband, she doesn't want her mate's company when swimming. She needs only to know the island waits there.
Torvald blinked, then frowned.
You're telling me to get lost.
Leave me my traipsing through the market, darling. No doubt you have manly tasks to pursue, perhaps at a nearby tavern. I'll see you at home this evening.
If that's how you want it, then of course I will leave you to it, sweetness. And yes, I could do with a wonder. A man has secrets, too.
Indeed, and she smiled. Provided they're not the kind that, if I find out, I will have to hunt you down and kill you.
He blanched.
No, of course not. Nothing like that.
Good. See you later, then.
And being a brave man, a contented man, more or less, Torvald Nom happily fled his wife, as brave, contented men are wont to do the world over.
Need to plough that field behind the windbreak, love. Going to head out now and drop the nets. Better sand down that tabletop. Time to go out and rob somebody, sweetness.
Yes, men did as they did, just as women did as they did, mysterious and inexplicable as those doings might be. And so thinking, it was not long before Torvald Nom found himself walking into the Phoenix Inn, a man looking for work in all the wrong places. Scorch arrived a short time later, pride and panic warring in his face, and my, how that pride blazed as he strutted up to where Torvald Nom was sitting. Back at the estate, Castellan Studlock brought Lef into an annex to one side of the main building, where after some rummaging in crates stuffed with straw, the muffled figure found a small glass bottle and presented it to Lef.
2 drops into each eye, 2 more onto the tongue. Repeat 2 more times today and 3 times a day until the bottle is empty.
That will kill them worms in my head?
The Greva worms, yes. I cannot vouch for any others.
I got more worms in my head?
Who can say? Do your thoughts squirm?
Sometimes. Gods below. two possibilities, Studlock said. Suspicion worms or guilt worms?
Leff scowled.
You saying it's worms calls those things? Guilt and suspicion? I ain't never heard anything like that.
Are you sometimes gnawed with doubt? Do notions take root in your mind? Do strange ideas slither into your head? Are you unaccountably frightened at the sight of a fisher's barbed hook? Are you some kind of healer? I am what one needs me to be. Now, let us find you a uniform.
Torvald Nom was rehearsing what he would tell his wife, carefully weighing each word, trying out in his mind the necessary nonchalance required to deftly avoid certain details of his newfound employment.
It's great that we're all working together again, Scorch said, ambling happily at his side. As estate guards, no less. No more strong-arm work for smelly criminals. No more hunting down losers to please some vicious piranha. No more...
Did this castellan mention the wages?
Huh? No, but it's bound to be good. Must be. It's demanding work.
Scorch, it may be lots of things, but demanding isn't one of them. We're there to keep thieves out, and since all three of us have been thieves ourselves at one time or another, we should be pretty damned good at it. We'd better be, or we'll get fired.
We need two more people. He wanted three more, and all I got was you. So, two more. Can you think of anybody?
No. What family?
What?
This mistress, what house does she belong to?
Don't know.
What's her name?
No idea.
She's from the countryside?
Think so.
Well, has any noble died recently that might have pulled her in? Inheritance, I mean?
How should I know? You think I bother keeping track of who's dead in that crowd? They ain't nothing to me, is my point.
We should have asked Cropper. He'd know.
Well, we didn't, and it don't matter at all. We got us legitimate work, the three of us. We're on our way to being, well, legitimate. So just stop questioning everything, Tor. You're going to ruin it.
How can a few reasonable questions ruin anything?
It just makes me nervous, Scorch replied. Oh, by the way, you can't see the castellan.
Why? Who else would I talk to about getting hired?
No, that's not what I mean. I mean you can't see him, all wrapped up in rags, with a hood and gloves and a mask. That's what I mean. His name is Studlock.
You can't be serious.
Why not? That's his name.
The castellan is bundled like a corpse, and you don't find that somewhat unusual?
Could be afraid of the sun or something. No reason to be suspicious. You never met any strange people in your day, Tor?
And Torvald Nom glanced across at Scorch and found he had no reply to that at all.
I see you have found another candidate, Studlock said. Excellent. And yes, he will do nicely. Perhaps as the captain of the house guard?
Torvald started.
I haven't said a word yet, and already I'm promoted? Comparative exercise yields confidence in this assessment. Your name is Torvald Nom, of House Nom. Might this not prove a conflict of interest?
Might it? Why?
The mistress is about to assume the vacant seat on the council.
Oh, well, I have virtually no standing in the affairs of House Nom. There are scores of us in the city, of course, with ties stretching everywhere, including off-continent. I, however, am not involved in any of that.
Were you cast out?
No, nothing so, extreme. It was more a question of interests.
You lack ambition.
Precisely.
That is a fine manicure, Torvald Nom.
Thank you. I could recommend...
But that notion dwindled into a painful silence, and Torvald tried hard not to glance down at the castellan's bandaged fingers. At this moment, Leff appeared from round the other side of the main house. His lips and his eyes were bright orange. Scorch grunted.
Hey, Leff! Remember that cat you sat on in that bar once?
What of it?
Nothing. Was just reminded the way its eyes went all bulgy and crazed.
What's that supposed to mean?
Nothing. Was just reminded is all. Look, I brought Tor.
I see that, snarled Lef. I can see just fine, thank you. What's wrong with your eyes? Torvald Norm asked. Tincture, said Lef. I got me a case of Greva worms.
Torvald Norm frowned.
Humans can't get Greva worms. Fish get Greva worms from eating infected conch.
Lef's bulging orange eyes bulged even more. Then he spun to face the Castellan, who shrugged and said,
Jurben worms?
Torvald Norm snorted.
The ones that live in the caverns below, in pockets of green gas? They're as long as a man's leg and nearly as thick.
The Castellan sighed.
The spectre of misdiagnosis haunts us all. I do apologize, Lef.
Perhaps your ailments are due to some other malady. No matter, the drops will wash out in a month or two.
I'm gonna have squished cat eyes for another month?
Preferable to Greva worms, I should think. Now, gentlemen, let us find the house clothier. Something black and brocaded in gold thread, I should imagine. House colours and all that. And then a brief summary of your duties, shifts, days off, and the like.
Would that summary include wages?
Torvald Norm asked.
Naturally. As captain, you will be paid 20 silver councils per week, Torvald Norm. Scorch and Lef, as guards, at 15. Acceptable?
All three quickly nodded. He felt slightly shaky on his feet, but Murillo knew that had nothing to do with any residue of weakness left by his wound. This weakness belonged to his spirit, as if age had sprung onto his back with claws digging into every joint and now hung there, growing heavier by the moment. He walked hunched at the shoulders, and this seemed to have arrived like a new habit, or perhaps it was always there, and only now, in his extremity, had he become aware of it. That drunken pup's sword thrust had pierced something vital indeed, and no Malazan healer or any other kind of healer could mend it. He tried forcing confidence into his stride as he made his way down the crowded street, but it was not an easy task.
Half drunk, breeches at my ankles, worthwhile excuses for what happened that night. The widow Sephala spitting venom once she sobered up enough to realize what had happened, and spitting it still, it seems. What had happened, yes, with her daughter. Oh, not rape. Too much triumph in the girl's eyes for that, though her face glowed with delight at her escort's charge to defend her honour. Once the shock wore off, I should never have gone back to explain.
But that was yesterday's nightmare, all those sparks raining down on the domestic scene with its airs of concern, every cagey word painting over the cracks in savage, short jabs of the brush. What had he expected? What had he gone there to find?
Reassurance? Maybe. I guess I arrived with my own brush.
Years ago, he would have smoothed everything over, almost effortlessly. A murmur here, a meeting of gazes there, soft touch with one hand, the barest hint of pressure. Then again, years ago,
it would never have happened in the first place, that drunken fool.
Oh, he'd growled those three words often in his head. But did they refer to the young man with the sword or to himself? Arriving at the large dueling school, he made his way through the open gate and emerged into the bright sunlight of the training ground. A score of young, sweating, overweight students scraped about in the dust, wooden weapons clattering. Most, he saw at once, lacked the necessary aggression, the killer's instinct. They danced to avoid, prodding the stick points forward with lack of any commitment. Their footwork, he saw, was abysmal. The class instructor was standing in the shade of a column in the colonnaded corridor just beyond. She was not even observing the mayhem in the compound, intent, it seemed, on some loose stitching or tear in one of her leather gauntlets. Making his way along one side of the mob, getting lost in clouds of white dust, Murillo approached the instructor. She noted him briefly, then returned her attention to the gauntlet.
"Excuse me," Murillo said as he arrived. "Are you the dueling mistress?"
"I am."
She nodded without looking at the students, where a couple of fights had started for real.
"How am I doing so far?"
Murillo glanced over and studied the fracas for a moment.
"That depends,"
he said. She grunted.
"Good answer. What can I do for you? Do you have some grandson or daughter you want thrown in there? Your clothes were expensive, once. As it looks, I doubt you can afford this school, unless, of course, you're one of those stinking rich who make a point of dressing all threadbare, old money and all that."
"Quite a sales pitch," Murillo observed. "Does it actually work?"
"Classes are full. There's a waiting list."
"I was wondering if you need help with basic instruction."
"What school trained you, then?"
"Karpala,"
she snorted.
"He took one student every 3 years."
"Yes."
And now she looked at him with an intensity he'd not seen before.
"Last I heard, there were 7 students of his left in the city."
5, actually. Fedel tumbled down a flight of stairs and broke his neck. He was drunk.
Sant Bala was stabbed through the heart by Gorlas Vidicus, the brat's first series victory."
Murillo grimaced.
"Not much of a duel. Sant Bala had gone mostly blind, but was too proud to admit it. A cut on the wrist would have given Gorlas his triumph."
"The young ones prefer killing to wounding."
"It's what dueling has come to, yes. Fortunately, most of your students here are more likely to stab themselves than any opponent they might one day face, and such wounds are rarely fatal."
"Your name?"
"Murillo."
She nodded as if she'd already guessed.
"And you're here because you want to teach? If you'd taken up teaching when Karpala was still alive..."
"He would have hunted me down and killed me, yes. He despised schools. In fact, he despised dueling. He once said teaching the rapier was like putting a poisonous snake into a child's hand. He drew no pleasure from instruction and was not at all surprised when very nearly every one of his prize students either got themselves killed or wasted away as drunkards or worse."
"You did neither?"
"No, that's true. I chased women."
"Only now they're too fast for you?"
"Something like that."
"I am Stoni Menakis. This school exists to make me rich, and yes, it's working. Tell me, will you be sharing your old master's hatred of teaching?"
"Not as vehemently, I imagine. I don't expect to take any pleasure in it, but I will do what's needed."
"Footwork," he nodded.
"Footwork, the art of running away. And forms, the defensive cage, since that will keep them alive. Stop hits to the wrist, knee, foot."
"Non-lethal?"
"Yes."
She sighed and straightened.
"All right, assuming I can afford you."
"I'm sure you can."
She shot him a quizzical glance and then added,
"Don't think about chasing me, by the way."
"I am finished with all that. Or rather, it's finished with me."
"Good."
At this moment, they both noticed that a woman had come up to them. Stoni's voice was suddenly different as she said,
"Merla, what are you doing here?"
"I've been looking for Gruntle.
That fool went off with the Trigal. I warned him, and now he's going to get himself killed for no good reason."
"Oh, it's Harlow, you see. What about him?"
The woman was flinching at everything Stoni said, and Murillo suspected he would have done the same in the face of such a tone.
"He's gone missing."
"What? For how long?"
"Snell said he saw him 2 days back, down at the docks. He's never not come home at day's end. He's only 5.
2 days.
Murillo saw that Stoni's face had gone white as death, and a sudden terror was growing in her eyes.
2 days. Snell says, "You stupid woman, Snell is a liar, a damned thief."
Merla stepped back under the onslaught.
"He gave us the coin you brought. After I nearly had to strangle him, yes. What's Snell done to Harlow? What's he done?"
Merla was weeping now, wringing her chapped hands.
"Said he done nothing, Stoni."
"A moment,"
cut in Murillo, physically stepping between the two women as he saw Stoni about to move forward, gloved hand lifting.
"A child's gone missing. I can put out the word. I know all sorts of people. Please, we can do this logically. Down at the docks, you said? We'll need to find out which ships left harbour in the last 2 days. The trading season's only just starting, so there shouldn't be many. His name is Harlow, and he's 5 years old. Gods below, you send him out into the streets, and he's only 5? Can you give me a description? Hair, eyes, the like?
Merla was nodding, even as tears streamed down her lined cheeks and her entire body trembled. She nodded and kept on nodding. Stonny spun round and rushed away, boots echoing harshly down the corridor. Murillo stared after her in astonishment.
Well, what?
It's her son, you see, said Merla between sobs. Her only son, only she don't want him, and so he's with us. But Snell, he has bad thoughts and does bad things sometimes, only not this, never this bad. He wouldn't do anything this bad to Harlow, he wouldn't.
We'll find him, said Murillo. One way or the other, ladies Paul bless us, and bless the lad. Now, please, describe him, and describe him well, what he normally does each day. I need to know that, too. Everything you can tell me, Merla. Everything.
Snell understood, in a dim but accurate way, how others, wishing only the best in him, could have their faith abused at will. And even should some truth be dragged into the light, well, it was then a matter of displaying crushed self-pity, and the great defender would take him into her arms, as mothers do. Can we hope that on rare occasions, perhaps late at night when the terrors crept close, he would think about how things he'd done could damage his mother's faith, and not just in him, but in herself as well? The son, after all, is but an extension of the mother. At least so the mother believed, there in some inarticulate part of her soul, unseen, yet solid as an iron chain. Assail the child, and so too the mother is assailed, for what is challenged is her life as a mother, the lessons she taught or didn't teach, the things she chose not to see, to explain away, to pretend were otherwise than what they were. Weep for the mother. Snell won't, and he never would, saving all his future to weep exclusively for himself. The creeping terrors awakened startling glimmers of thought, of near empathy, but they never went so far as to lead to any self-recognition or compassion for the mother who loved him unconditionally. His nature was the kind that took whatever was given to him as if it was a birthright, all of it, forever and evermore. Rage at injustice came when something, anything, was withheld. Things he righteously deserved, and of course he deserved everything he wanted. All that he wanted, he reached for, and oh, such fury if those things eluded his grasp or were then taken away. In the absence of what might be imposed, a child will fashion the structure of the world to suit itself. Created from a mind barely awake, and clearly not even that when it came to introspection, that world becomes a strange place indeed. But let us not rail at the failings of nearby adults tied by blood or whatever. Some children are born in a cage. It's already there, in their skulls, and it's a dark cage. He was wandering the streets, fleeing all the cruel questions being flung at him. They had no right to accuse him like that. Oh, when he was all grown up, nobody would be allowed to get after him like this. He'd break their faces, he'd step on their heads, he'd make them afraid, every one of them, so he could go on doing whatever he liked. He couldn't wait to get older, and that was the truth. And yet, he found himself heading for Two Ox Gate. He needed to know, after all, was Harlow still lying there? He hadn't hit him so hard, had he? Enough to kill him? Only if Harlow had been born weak, only if something was wrong with him from the start. And that wouldn't be a surprise, would it? Harlow's own mother had thrown him away, after all. So if Harlow was lying dead in the grasses on that hilltop, why, it wasn't Snell's fault, was it? Something would have killed him sooner or later. So that was a relief, but he'd better go and find out for sure. What if Harlow hadn't died at all? What if he was out there somewhere planning murder? He could be spying on Snell right now, with a knife he'd found, or a knotted stick. Quick, cunning, able to dart out of sight no matter how fast Snell spun round on the street, he was out there, waiting, stalking. Snell needed to prove things, and that was why he was running through Meyten. where the stink of Brown Run Bay and the lepers was nearly enough to make him retch, and ha! Listen to them scream when struck by the bigger stones he threw at them. He was tempted to tarry for a time, to find one of the uglier ones he could stone again and again until the cries just went away, and wouldn't that be a mercy? Better than rotting away. But no, not yet. Maybe on the way back, after he'd stood for a time, looking down at the fly-blown corpse of Harlow. That would be the perfect conclusion to this day, after all. His problem solved. Nobody hunting him in the shadows. He'd throw stones fast and hard then, a human catapult, smack, crush the flimsy skull. Maybe he wasn't grown up yet, but he could still do things. He could take lives. He left the road, made his way up the hill. This was the place, all right. How could he forget? Every detail was burned into his brain. The first giant tapestry in the history of Snell. Slaying his evil rival, and see the dragons wheeling in the sky above the lake. Witnesses! The slope unaccountably tired him, brought a tremble to his legs. Just nervousness, of course. His shins stung as he rushed through the grasses and came to the place. No body. Sudden terror. Snell looked round on all sides. He was out there. Wasn't hurt at all. He'd probably faked the whole thing, biting down on his pain with every kick. Hiding, yes, just to get Snell in trouble, and when Gruntle came back, there'd be Hood to pay. Gruntle, who made Harlow his favourite because Harlow did things to help out, but wasn't it Snell who brought back that last sack of fuel? It was. Of course, Gruntle wasn't there to see that, was he? So he didn't know anything, because if he did, he'd kill me. Cold, shivering in the lake wind, Snell ran back down the hill. He needed to get home, maybe not right home, but somewhere close, so he could jump Harlow when he showed up to tell his lies about what had happened. Lies! Snell had no bag of coins, did he? Harlow's mother's coins. Ha! Wasn't that funny? She was rich enough anyway, and Snell deserved that money as much as anyone else. He reached up and tenderly touched the swelling on his left cheek. The bitch had hit him, all to steal back the money. Well, she'd pay one day, yes, she would. One day, yes, he'd be all grown up, and then, look out! It had taken the death of a once-famous duelist before people started treating Gorlas Vidicus as an adult. But now he was a man indeed, a feared one, a member of the council. He was wealthy, but not yet disgustingly rich. Although that was only a matter of time. Fools the world over worshipped gods and goddesses, but coin was the only thing worth worshipping, because to worship it was to see it grow more and ever more, and all that he took for himself he took from someone else, and this was where the real conquest happened. Day by day, deal by deal, and winning these games was proof of true faith and worship, and oh, how deliciously satisfying. Fools dropped coins into collection bowls. The rich cleaned those bowls out, and this was the true division of humanity. But more than that, the rich decided how many coins the fools had to spare, and how did that rate as power? Which side was preferable? As if the question needed asking. Coin purchased power, like a god blessing the devout. But of both power and wealth, there could never be enough. As for the victims, well, there could never be enough of them either. Someone was needed to clean the streets of the estate district. Someone was needed to wash clothes, bedding, and the like. Someone was needed to make the damned things in the first place. And someone was needed to fight the wars when the rich decided they wanted still more of whatever was out there. Gorlas Vidicus, born to wealth and bred to title, found life to be good. But it could be better still, and the steps to improvement were simple enough. "Darling wife," he now said as she was rising to leave, "I must take a trip and will not return until tomorrow or even the day after." She paused, watching in a distracted way as the servants closed in to collect the dishes from the late breakfast, calloused hands darting in like featherless birds, and said,
"Oh?"
"Yes. I have been granted the overseer title of an operation out of the city, and I must visit the workings.
Thereafter, I must take ship to Gredfallen Annex to finalize a contract.
Very well, husband.
There was no advance notice of any of this, Gorlas added, and alas, I had intended invitations to both Shardan and Hannot to dine with us this evening. He paused to smile at her. I leave them in your capable hands. Please do extend my apologies. She was staring down at him in a somewhat disconcerting way.
You wish me to host your two friends tonight?
Of course.
I see.
And perhaps she did at that. Yet was she railing at him? No. And was there perhaps the flush of excitement on her cheeks now? But she was turning away, so he could not be sure, and walking, hips swaying in that admirable way of hers, right out of the room. And there, what was done was done. He rose and gestured to his manservant. Make ready the carriage. I am leaving immediately. Head bobbing, the man hurried off. Someone was needed to groom the horses, to check the tack, to keep the carriage clean and the brakes in working order. Someone was needed to ensure he had all he required in the travel trunks. And, as it happened, someone was needed for other things besides, like spreading the legs as a reward for past favours and as a future debt when it was time to turn everything round. They could take his wife. He would take them one day, everything they owned, everything they dreamed of owning. After tonight, he would own one of them or both of them, both for certain in the weeks to come. Which one would produce Gorlas's heir? He didn't care. Chalice's getting pregnant would get his parents off his back at the very least, and might well add the reward of satisfying her, and so wiping that faint misery from her face and bringing an end to all those irritating sighs and longing faraway looks out of the windows. Besides, she worshipped money too. Hood knew she spent enough of it on precious trinkets and useless indulgences. Give her a child and then three or four more, and she'd be no further trouble and content besides. Sacrifices needed to be made. So make it, wife, and who knows, you might even be smiling when it's done with. A bell and a half later, the Vidicus carriage was finally clearing Tuok's gate, and the horses picked up their pace as the road opened out, cutting through the misery of Maten, and where else should the lost and the hopeless go but outside the city walls, which Gorlas suffered with closed shutters and a scent ball held to his nose. When he ruled, he'd order a massive pit dug out on the dwelling plain, and they would drag all these wasted creatures out there and bury the lot of them. It was simple enough. Can't pay for a healer, and that's just too bad. But look, we won't charge for the burial. Luxuriating in such thoughts and other civic improvements, Gorlas dozed as the carriage rumbled onward. Chalice stood alone in her private chambers, staring at the hemisphere of glass with its trapped moon. What would she lose? Her reputation? Or rather, that reputation would change. Hannot grinning, Shardan strutting in that knowing way of his, making sure his secret oozed from every pore so that it was anything but a secret. Other men would come to her, expecting pretty much the same, and maybe by then there would be no stopping her. And maybe, before too long, she'd find one man who decided that what he felt was love, and she would then begin to unveil her plan, the only plan she had, and it certainly made sense, eminently logical, even reasonable, justifiable. Sometimes the beast on its chain turns on its master, sometimes it goes for his throat, and sometimes it gets there. But it would take time. Neither Shardan Lim nor Hannot Orr would do. Both needed Gorlas, even though their triumvirate was a partnership of convenience. Any one of them would turn on the other if the situation presented itself, but not yet, not for a long while, she suspected. Could she do this?
What is my life? Here, look around. What is it?
She had no answer to that question. She was like a jeweler, blind to the notion of value. Shiny or dull, it didn't matter. Rare or abundant, the only difference lay in desire, and how could one weigh that, when the need behind it was the same? The same, yes, in all its sordid hunger. She could reduce all her needs to but one. She could do that. She would have to stomach what was to come.
She felt cold, could see the purple tracks through the pallid white skin of her arms as her blood flowed turgidly on. She needed to walk in sunlight, to feel the heat, and know that people would look upon her as she passed, on her fine cape of ermine with its borders of black silk sewn with silvered thread, on the bracelets on her wrists and down at her ankles. Too much jewellery invited the thief's snatching hand, after all, and was crass besides. And her long hair would glisten with its scented oils, and there would be a certain look in her eyes, lazy, satiated, seductively sealed away, so that it seemed she took notice of nothing and no one. And this was, she well knew, a most enticing look in what were still beautiful eyes. She found herself looking into them, there in the mirror, still clear even after half a carafe of wine at breakfast, and then the pipe of rust-leaf afterwards, and she had a sudden sense that the next time she stood thus, the face staring back at her would belong to someone else, another woman wearing her skin, her face. A stranger far more knowing, far wiser in the world's dismal ways than this one before her now. Was she looking forward to making her acquaintance? It was possible. The day beckoned and she turned away, before she saw too much of the woman she was leaving behind, and set about dressing for the city.
"So you're the historian who survived the chain of dogs?"
The old man sitting at the table looked up and frowned.
"Actually, I didn't."
"Oh," said Silara, settling down into the chair opposite him. Her body felt strange today, as if even fat could be weightless.
Granted, she wasn't getting any heavier, but her bones were wearing plenty, and there was a sense of fullness, of roundness, and for some reason all of this was making her feel sexually charged, very nearly brimming over with a slow, sultry indolence. She drew out her pipe and eyed the Malazan opposite.
"Well, I'm sorry to hear that."
"It's a long story," he said.
"Which you're relating to that ponytailed bard?"
He grunted.
"So much for privacy."
"Sounds to be a good thing, getting it all out. When he found out I was in Shaikh's camp in Raraku, he thought to cajole details out of me. But I was barely conscious most of that time, so I wasn't much help. I told him about Heborik, though."
And Dyker slowly straightened, a sudden glint in his eyes, burning away all the sadness, all the weariness.
"Heborik?"
Silara smiled.
"Fisher said you might be interested in that."
"I am. Or," he hesitated, "I think I am."
"He died, I'm afraid. But I will tell you of it, if you'd like. From the night we fled Shaikh."
The light had dimmed in Dyker's eyes, and he looked away.
"Hood seems determined to leave me the last one standing. All my friends."
"Old friends, maybe," she said, pulling flame into the bowl. "Plenty of room for new ones."
"That's a bitter consolation."
"We need to walk, I think."
"I'm not in the mood."
"But I am, and Barathol is gone, and your partners are upstairs chewing on conspiracies. Char is in the kitchen, eating everything in sight, and Blend's fallen in love with me, and sure, that's amusing and even enjoyable for a time. But for me, it's not the real thing. Only she's not listening. Anyway, I want an escort, and you're elected."
"Really, Silara?"
"Being old doesn't mean you can be rude. I want you to take me to the Phoenix Inn."
He stared at her for a long moment. She drew hard on her pipe, swelled her lungs to thrust her ample breasts out, and saw how his gaze dropped a fraction or two.
"I'm looking to embarrass a friend, you see," she said,
then released the lungful of smoke towards the black-stained rafters.
"Well," he sourly drawled, "in that case." "Ralik's furious,"
Cutter said as he sat down, reaching for the brick of cheese to break off a sizable chunk which he held in his left hand, an apple in his right. A bite from the apple was quickly followed by one from the cheese.
"Crupper commiserates. Tragedy of destiny, when destiny is that which one chooses, given what one is given. Dear Cutter might have retained original name had he elected a life in, say, Murillo's shadow. Alas, Cutter in name is Cutter indeed."
Cutter swallowed and said,
"Hold on,
I wasn't making a point of walking in Ralik's shadow. Not anybody's shadow. In fact, the whole idea of shadow makes me sick. If one god out there has truly cursed me, it's Shadow Throne.
Shifty Shadow Throne, he of the sauceless shade, a most conniving, dastardly god indeed. Chill is his shadow, cruel and uncomfortable is his throne, horrid his hounds, tangled his rope, sweet and seductive his innocent servants. But, and Crupper held aloft one plump finger, Cutter would not speak of walking in shadows. Why, not anyone's? Even one which sways most swayingly, that cleaves most cleavingly, that flutters in fluttering eyelashes, framing depthless dark eyes that are not eyes at all, but pools of unfathomable depth. And is she sorry? By Apsalar, she is not.
I hate you sometimes, Cutter said in a grumble, eyes on the table, cheese and apple temporarily forgotten in his hands.
Poor Cutter! See his heart carved loose from yon chest, flopping down like so much bloodied meat on this tabletop. Crupper sighs and sighs again in the deep of sympathy and extends, yes, this warm cloak of companionship against the cold, harsh light of truth this day and on every other day. Now, kindly pour us more of this herbal concoction, which, whilst tasting somewhat reminiscent of the straw and mud used to make bricks, is assured by Meese to aid in all matters of digestion, including bad news.
Cutter poured, and then took another two bites, apple and cheese. He chewed for a time, then scowled.
What bad news? That which is yet to arrive, of course. Will honey aid this digestive aid? Probably not. It will, one suspects, curdle and recoil. Why is it, Crupper wonders, that those who claim all healthy amends via rank brews, gritty grey repasts of the raw and unrefined, and unpalatable potions, and this amidst a regime of activities invented solely to erode bone and wear out muscle, all these purveyors of the pure and good life are revealed one and all as one, parched, well-nigh bloodless, with vast fists bobbing up and down in the throat, and watery eyes savage in righteous smuggitude, walking like energized storks and urinating water pure enough to drink all over again. And pass, if you please, to dear beatific Crupper, then, that last pastry squatting forlorn and alone on yon pewter plate.
Cutter blinked.
Sorry, pass what?
Pastry, dear lad! Sweet pleasures to confound the pious worshippers of suffering. How many lives do each of us have, Crupper wonders rhetorically, to so constrain this one with desultory disciplines so efficacious that Hood himself must bend over convulsed in laughter? This evening, dear friend of Crupper, you and I will walk the cemetery and wager which buried bones belong to the healthy ones and which to the wild, cavorting, headlong maniacs who danced bright with smiles each and every day.
The healthy bones would be the ones left by old people, I'd wager.
No doubt, no doubt, friend Cutter, a most stolid truth. Why, Crupper daily encounters ancient folk and delights in their wide smiles and cheery well-mets.
They're not all miserable, Crupper.
True, here and there totters a wide-eyed one, wide-eyed because a life of raucous abandon is behind one, and the fool went and survived it all. Now what, this creature wonders, why am I not dead? And you, with your 3 paltry decades of pristine boredom, why don't you just go somewhere and die?
Are you being hounded by the aged, Crupper? Worse, dear Murillo moans crabby and toothless, and now ponders a life of inactivity.
Promise Crupper this, dear Cutter, when you see this beaming paragon here before you falter, dribble at the mouth, mutter at the clouds, wheeze and fart and trickle and all the rest, do bundle Crupper up tight in some thick impervious sack of burlap, find a nearby cliff and send him sailing out. Through the air, down onto the thrashing seas and crashing rocks and filmy foams, Crupper implores you. And listen, whilst you do so, friend Cutter, sing and laugh, spit into my wake. Do you so promise?
If I'm around, Crupper, I'll do precisely as you ask.
Crupper is relieved, so relieved.
Aye, last pastry revolts in nether gut. More of this tea, then, to yield the bitumen belch of tasteless misery on earth. And then, shortly anon, it will be time for lunch. And see who enters. Why, none other than Murillo, newly employed and flush and so eager with generosity.